Hello and welcome to the Voice of Intuition podcast. I'm Susan Jane and I'm your host for this podcast. And today, oh gosh, I say this every time. I do apologize for those who listen all the time, but I say it every time because I love the guests I have on. And today we've got a really exciting talk because we're talking about near-death experiences. And why I'm excited about this is because Nicole has had one and hers is different to mine. So we can talk about it. This is going to be really cool. But before we go any further, could you please like, share and subscribe to the podcast so we can get it out to everyone. This is really interesting because one of the things that happened with me is that I wasn't aware that I had a near-death experience until I read a book about them, and it was probably 15 years later. I read a book and thought, oh, this sounds interesting. What's this all about? And read this book and then realized in this book it had examples of other people's experiences. And as I'm reading it, I've gone, oh, wow, that's a bit scary because that's what happened to me. And it was little bits of different ones. So it was really interesting. Again, I didn't know I had it until well and truly later. And this is what's really important about listening to the podcast and getting an understanding of it or purchasing books. You start to learn more about the things that have happened to you that you aren't even aware of half the time, or you didn't understand what they were. But with no further ado, we're going to have Nicole on. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Thank you, Susan. I'm delighted to be here from North Carolina in the United States.
Yes, so it's 7 p.m. with Nicole, and here on the Gold Coast in Australia, Queensland, Australia, it is just gone 9 o'clock. In the morning.
That's why it's so dark here. We're in about to go into daylight savings time, but it's getting dark here really early. So
Wow. All right. I want to get an understanding first before we talk about near-death experiences. I want to get an understanding of your background a little bit because you were in the
United States Air Force Academy.
Air Force, that's right. Yes. Sorry, I did sort of stalk you a little bit on your website, but I couldn't remember all the details.
Doing your homework.
So I want to get a bit of an understanding of your life up to now, because you can touch on when you had that near-death experience, but I want to get a little bit of understanding of how you've got to where you are. It's a little bit more about you before we go into the details.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, which is southern United States. So very much, I would say, in the 70s, where it was pretty racially charged, a lot of forced integration. I went to both public and to private schools, so I understand, you know, what it's like to go to an all African American school. And I also grew up in what we call the Bible Belt, so a very religious part of the United States. My mother was Lutheran, my dad is Southern Baptist, so we got a double dose of religion every Sunday and Wednesday. So spent a lot of time in church, and interestingly enough, both of those theologies both claim that they have the right way to God, right? And so, yeah. You know, it's just different rules, so to speak. So grew up with that. And then, of course, the South is known for its fried food and sweet tea and all that good stuff. So we have, you know, unfortunately, a lot of chronic diseases down there with people. And it's unfortunate, but it's just a way of life, you know, for people there. And then once I got out of high school, my dad was a 1960 graduate of the Air Force Academy, which is in Colorado Springs. And he wanted one of us four kids to go. And I signed up because I wanted to be daddy's girl. And I have two brothers, but they didn't have the academics, or the eyesight to get in. So I stepped up for that. And in 1976, the U.S. decided to admit women to their military academies. So that's West Point, the Air Force Academy, the Naval Academy, and integrate the women with the men. So the first class to graduate was 80 and mine was 86. So you can see I was one of the first women that was in the academy. And it was a very abusive environment. I'm not kidding. It was sexually abusive because you have 4,000 guys and maybe a couple hundred women. And you had physical abuse going on, especially as a freshman. The hazing does go on. It's part of the ritual, the tradition to kind of crap on the lower classmen, you know? Mm-hmm. And then you had emotional and verbal abuse. You know, they were constantly yelling at you and not nice names. You know, it's all designed to break you down as an individual and then supposedly build you up as a team. So I knew when basic training came that this place was not for me, but I couldn't quit. I couldn't deal with being a failure. I couldn't even imagine going back, because it's so much work to get in the academies. You have to have a congressional nomination. You have to do good on your academic scores, your physical scores. It's just such an arduous process. And I just, the shame would have been too great. I just couldn't do it, but I knew my soul was in the wrong place. I was not meant to. Ultimately, the military, you know, is called on to defend the country, which means you are taught how to kill people. And that's just not who I am. That's not what my soul is about. But yet that's what I was in there doing. I was learning how to shoot guns. I was learning how to, you know, go on combat courses and things like that. So anyway, my sophomore year is when my crash happened. And that was when my near-death experience happened. And it took me 4 months in a hospital, 8 months of physical therapy to recover from it. But my memory of the crash did not come back for 19 years. So I went on with my life in that 19 years, but I was having a lot of problems. I developed an eating disorder. I did not get any psychology or mental health help during that time. My parents did not believe in that. They believed that Jesus and God were my counselor. And that just wasn't true. I needed mental health. I was in a lot of pain. I was in a lot of trauma. And you need to heal those trauma wounds or you're going to keep going down this spiral.
Yes.
When the memory came back, I had gone to school and I graduated from Southern Methodist, which is in Texas, and I got a degree in public relations. I thought that's what I had wanted to do. But then with the eating disorder, I switched into nutrition, thinking that I could fix myself. And I think a lot of us will do that. We'll go into a field where we're having our own issues and think if we get enough knowledge that we can heal ourselves. And of course, this isn't about the food. An eating disorder is about, you know, lack of control in a situation. It's about mental issues. So it's not about eating a controlled amount of food. And I didn't know any of that, but went on to become a registered dietitian nutritionist and try to help other people with their eating disorders. So, worked at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is our highest public health agency in America. Very prestigious up until the pandemic. Then I think it just took a lot of wrong hits in the wrong direction, but I got an advanced degree in public health nutrition and really wanted to help prevent disease and chronic disease, especially with people. So I had a variety of jobs over the last 30 years and have worked in all sectors of our society, including hospitals. I was an oncology dietitian. I was a wellness director at a hospital. I ran a diabetes clinic, a kidney. So, you know, I know the diseases and I know what we're supposed to be doing for them. And most people know if they have diabetes or kidney, what they need to do, but then they will sabotage themselves. They will get in a situation where they get triggered and they don't know why they're triggered. And they'll want to reach for for the most part, comfort food. That's why you can know, okay, I don't need to be eating this whole pint of Ben and Jerry's, you know, monkey chunky or whatever it is. But when that, your prefrontal cortex up here is what makes all that executive reasoning decisioning, right? So that amygdala in your back, those two little almond shapes, man, you get triggered, it just hijacks that prefrontal cortex and you get into fight, flight, or freeze. So you're not going to make a rational decision about Ben and Jerry's or pizza or whatever kind of comfort feed. You need that dopamine hit because this is too uncomfortable for you. So I started realizing I could put people on diets and it's like, okay, this isn't working because you get stressed out or you get triggered and you go back to what you know to comfort you, whether you know, it's food or shopping or whatever. But in my field, it was people going back to food. And so I went into something called neuroemotional technique to get at the unconscious because 5% of us is conscious is what is running our life. That other 95% has all been programmed long time ago. So you have to get at the unconscious belief system that is running your mind and your body, and you have to deal with that and the root issue, so to speak. And then you become aware of it and can change the behavior. So that's kind of been, I've been in the wellness field my whole life, but the first, if you look at the wellness wheel, it's the first quarter is the physical. So that's your diet and sleep and physical activity. And I have preached the eat your fruits and vegetables. You know, here in America, we're supposed to be at 9. And would you believe, Susan, we're still at 1.5 servings, which is what I started with 30 years ago. We just have such a hard time here eating more fruits and vegetables. And you would have thought with the pandemic, that would have been the message that our government would have been saying is, hey, boost your immune system, get some more vitamin D, some zinc, some C, but eat those fruits and vegetables and get those antioxidants. And it's going to really help your immune system. No, nothing like that preventative came out. It was just, you know, wait for the vaccine and people were really eating a lot of junk food and comfort food. And I understand that for a little while, but this thing went on for 2.5 years, you know, so you can't do that without suffering the consequences. So anyway, that's kind of, I lived in Hawaii for the last 17 years, met and married my husband there. My memory came back with the wreck. And I also realized why I had issues in relationships and why I could never sustain a relationship with a man. And as soon as that memory came back, I was able to resolve that problem. But I think, you know, this journey of mine, the first 19 years was, I didn't even know what happened, except I remembered one thing, bright white lights. That's all I remembered. And I asked my surgeon, I visited my surgeon, my nurse, and my EMT that found me in 2008, 25 years later, I sat and I had dinner with them and their respective spouses and had them tell me their stories again. And they knew it right off the bat. They could recite my case. And, you know, they were very much grateful for me to come back and had said that nobody had ever come back 25 years and thanked them for what, you know, that they did. And I didn't do it to get those kudos. I was really, I mean, they were a super team and I needed a super team to work on me because I was pronounced dead at the scene. So it's been a long trajectory to, and then when my memory came back, that started pretty much my spiritual journey. And that's been evolving. And I spent 13 years writing this book. Okay. You Are Deathless. So, I have so many writing prompts in my computer, Susan, I'm surprised it hasn't blown up the cloud. It is just, you know, it is, I'm a, by nature, I was raised science. Okay. CDC is science. So I know how to write peer-reviewed science articles, but writing a book for an audience that's the lay people is completely different. And in that, I exposed and I was vulnerable and, you know, it doesn't, I told my truth and it needed to come out. It helped me heal to write the book. It really did.
Very cathartic, isn't it? Yeah.
And I think that's why it's become a bestseller here. It's only been out 2 months and it's already sold over 500 copies, which most books, I don't know if people know this, most books, 10% of books will sell over 500 copies. The majority don't. They sell 100, maybe 200. So it's on the train moving fast here. And I think it's because people can relate. It's not just about my near death experience. I talk about trauma and how important it is that you have to heal trauma or you pass it on, and how you have to get rid of limiting beliefs in order to be the person that you need to be. And I talk about the 10 common lessons from near-death experiences, and they're all positive, because in our culture in America, death is really seen as doom and gloom. It's very depressing, very negative, and I want that to change, because death experience is beautiful. You go into the light. There is nothing to be afraid of. And that's what my message was on the other side, was don't be afraid of death. Hence, live your life fully, because if you are afraid, you're not going to be living fully.
Yes, absolutely. You know what's really strange, Nicole, the synchronicities between us, because I had my experience when I was very young, and I actually went and did a public health degree on health promotion. So we have a lot of synchronicities there. When I did my public health degree, I could choose nutrition. I didn't want to go that way. I wanted to be more, I wanted to do more of the getting that information out there, getting it known that these things were happening. So I wanted to do the promoting side of it. So it's really quite strange that, you know, there's a lot of synchronicities there.
Yeah.
But I do want to go back to, because we're talking about the near-death experience. I do want to go back to that, because you talk about a crash and what had happened there. And I noticed with a lot of the near-death experiences and why I questioned mine to start with, a lot of them are when it is a very traumatic situation, whereas mine wasn't. Which was quite weird. I just passed out. But when you're talking about writing the book, and we'll get back into that. You talk about writing the book. I've done my first book, which was one I downloaded from the ethers. That's all done. That took me 3 years to do, and I'm just pushing that forward now. But I'm halfway through another book, and once you start writing a book, you do, like you say, get into it. This one is more about my life and how you can learn to trust your intuition. It was more about my life, and I talk about my near-death experience in there and a very, very violent attack that I had. And it is cathartic. It's so I read over the story again, and I'll come into tears again reading my own story. It's like, well, I know the ending, I know what's going on, and yet you still feel it and you still go through it. So I can't recommend it highly enough. Writing a book is so, even if you never put it out there, it is so good for you. Mm-hmm. But let's go back. Sorry, I've just gone off tangent.
No, it's true. It is true. And it's very, you have to be disciplined about it. And that's very, very hard for us. It's like even journal writing, you know, you can do it for a while. And then if you're not getting the results that you want, or for whatever reason, you put it aside, you know, but you have to keep pushing yourself. So for those out there that are doing this, you know, you have to be persistent, and you just have to trust the divine timing if it's meant to get out to people. And that's the way I knew I had a message, and I just was like, well, that's a pretty big message. How in the world am I supposed to get that out? But it didn't come together until 40 years. This accident happened in 1983. So I feel like, you know, the Israelites in the Bible that were wandering around in the wilderness for 40 years, you know, it's taken me my whole adult life to get this message out and to really put it out in a way that people can understand it, because I think people will resonate with some of these parts. And, you know, especially with an eating disorder, that's a real secretive thing. People don't want to tell anybody that they're, you know, binge eating. Back in the day, it was called compulsive eating. And, you know, I suffered with that for 20 years. It did not stop until I got married, actually, when I was around 40. So I understand the pain that people are in when they're just shoving food down their mouth. And, you know, I also get it in terms of sexual abuse, because the accident turns out the guy was trying to make a sexual pass at me. And, you know, I said no. And then he turned the wheel and we were in a Corvette convertible and spun out. So, you know, that was my issue with men, is I was scared if I said no to them that unconsciously I could get killed. And so things like that start to make sense when you remember.
So when you're reflecting back, that's when you start to get that understanding. And I did that exactly the same. Like I said, I didn't understand what had happened until 15 odd years later, when, you know, I was doing my spiritual connection, reading books and everything else. And then I started going, well, hang on, that situation. And you start to reflect back and you get a better understanding of it. As you get a better understanding of it, you can learn to grow. When you know something,
yes,
you know where you're going and you know what you're doing. So that's why it's really important. But I do want to go back to the crash, and I want to go into a little bit more detail about that side of it if we can, if that's all right with you.
I haven't got a picture.
Hang on. Let me go to full screen for you. Hang on. Oh, that's what was left. Whoa.
That was left.
Yep. Yeah. Gosh.
Yeah, it was, that's my side. It was completely, and it's in the book too. I do put pictures in the book so that people can, you know, relate it. You know, I always wanted to be on the front page of the paper, but.
But not like that.
No. And then this was, that was the first picture taken of me about 4 weeks after the crash, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Mm. All right. So give us a little bit of a lead up to the crash and then where it went from there.
Yeah. You know, my soul was in the wrong place. I'm just going to be honest with you. And I was getting deeper and deeper into the system, and the academics were getting harder and harder for me. I am not the mind of an engineer, yet I was taking electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, you know, I'd already made a D in organic chemistry. You know, I'm not biochemistry. I did okay in, but I'm not that science kind of electrical engineer, engineering, nautical, aeronautical engineer type of brain. But yet that's the curriculum at the academy. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I'm going to fail out of here, you know? So I was dealing with that aspect of it. And also the fact that there's no fun there for me. You know, it was just constant. My adrenal glands were just on constant go, go, go. There it was just, here's the next thing. Here's the next thing. There's no downtime. There's no, you know, at a regular college or anything like that. It's just you have so much to do all the time in the different aspects. So I knew I didn't want to be there, but I still, even in my sophomore year, I couldn't quit, you know? And the first time was basic training, and I'm like 5'11". Okay. I used to model, and here I'm in fatigues with a gun trying to get through an obstacle course. And I was like Private Benjamin, you know. It was just like, this is a joke, you know. I'm just like, why am I doing this? And it was to please Dad. So that Sunday, I went and met with the Commandant of Cadets, and he wanted me to talk to some other female cadets that were thinking of coming to the Air Force Academy, and what a great opportunity it would be for him. And I'm like, oh boy. So I did it, and then went and joined my squadron, which is about 100 people, all different levels of first, second, third, fourth year. And they were doing like a kickoff for the year. It was August 28th. And at the end of it, we're not allowed to have cars until we're juniors and seniors. So I'm a sophomore. So I was one of the last to leave. And I asked one of the guys, who was a senior, if I could get a ride back with him. You know, he had a shiny red Corvette. And I was like, oh, this will be kind of fun, you know? But then he says, oh, let's stop and have a couple more beers. And I'm going, okay, we have to get back by 7:35 though, because I don't want to get in trouble at the beginning of the year. I've already been there, done that. And he's like, oh, we'll be fine. I'm a senior. I know what we can get away with. And I'm just like, okay. So we had a beer, had a cigarette. Then he's like, oh, let's go watch the sunset. Now here I am, Susan. I am so naive. I never had been on a date. Okay. My dad would not let me date. But he sends me to a place where he says, don't date, don't drink, and don't smoke. Okay. And I'm just going, well, what fun is there? And I'm deciding I'm going to have some fun. So then I start getting nervous because he wants to make out. And I'm like, I don't even know this guy hardly. And so I told him we had to get back on the road. And we did. And needless to say, at one point he tried to grab my crotch and I just said no. And he turned the wheel and it fishtailed and happened to hit a huge boulder, moved the boulder, flipped the car over. The car, we were thrown out. It did not have seat belts, which in this case was a good thing because we were thrown out and then it landed on its top, as you saw in that photo. And some people in a house nearby immediately heard it, came out, looked at both of us and couldn't get any vitals on me. And so they got some blankets and covered me up. And then the volunteer paramedics got there. And there's one in particular that I credit with saving my life, John. And he was saying how and I know this because he came to my hospital room, I would say about 10 weeks later, and told me what happened. And he said, when he got there, he said, I told them that nobody tells me when a victim's dead. And he said, I couldn't get any vitals out of you. So I did something called a sternal knuckle press, which is very painful. And it caused my right eye to flitter and the pupil to dilate. Now, what do we know about the eyes in terms of spirituality, Susan?
Well, I've always thought that the sound was the last thing to go, but
the eyes are the windows.
Yes. That's okay. Where I thought you were going. Yeah.
So that is when my soul came back in. It came back in my life and it came through in my eye. And that's what he got as a sign of life. They immediately got me in the bus and to a nearby community hospital that was not equipped for trauma. Turns out I had, amputated my left foot. I had broken both sides of my pelvis. I severed my right wrist, had a really bad road burn on the side of my cheek from skidding. Turns out I cut up all the inside of my legs, big hole I cut out. They had to skin graft that together again. So that took 4 months. I was in the hospital, 7 weeks in intensive care, 64 pints of blood. And we have about 8 pints in our body at a time, 8 to 10. So that's like redoing your blood almost eight times, you know? Mm. So I was a very, very, very sick girl. I had 2 code blues in operations where I didn't want to be here. And I was trying to leave again. And they got me going. Somehow I just kept coming back. And so I go into that in the book in a lot of detail in the first chapter. And I will say it was, I'm glad I don't remember the pain because when my memory came back 19 years later, what I remember was my spirit flew out before I hit the ground. And this being came and took me up and I could look down on myself and I could see I was in, I had my Azad teal shirt on. I had my khaki shorts. My tennis shoe was on one foot and not on the other. And I knew I was dead. And I was just like, uh-oh, I don't want to go back into that body. And they told me that that was going to happen. I was going to go back. And that my message to tell people was not to be afraid of death. And I was like, no, please. I love it up here. So needless to say, the spirit, I called it Casper the Ghost in the book, but I later, just a couple of weeks ago, realized it was my grandfather on my father's side, and he died at my current age in August. And that's when he came to me to say that he was the one that brought me back and said, no, you've got to go back, and you've got to do, you've got to break some, a new contract, you got to get a new contract, and you've got to break some of these belief systems and some of these identities that are causing people to be, unconscious, unaware, not being the being that they were born to be. Does that make sense?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. So you got a very distinct message.
And I also got another message, and that was me hearing other spirits having a conversation. So I wasn't in human form, but I could understand the conversation they were having. And they said that we here on Earth have to ask them for help. They're not going to just jump in and interfere. And that's because we have free will in this country, you know, in the world. So we need to be reminded. And this was me saying, okay, please remind people to ask for help from the angelic realm. We are waiting for their help. We will help them. It might be in the way that we think it needs to be, but it will be for our highest and greatest good. And that's how I pray now. Instead of for a certain outcome, I pray for the highest and greatest good of all to be done, because I don't know what that looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it can look so different to everybody else.
Absolutely.
I love how you sort of said you were obviously in the wrong place at the wrong time, but it was so dramatic the way they got you to change trajectories, you know. But it did make you think, didn't it? Because it's like, well, why wasn't I happy there? What was going on, and what was it all about? And once you've got that memory and you start getting that understanding, it makes your whole life change going forward. It just changes everything. And if people have had trauma and things like that, if they start to go back and have a look at it and get an understanding of it, and sometimes they may need to do that with professional help, but if they start doing that, it does make them go forward in a different way, and they can be changing completely without them realizing.
Absolutely. And I talk a lot about trauma in the book, and I actually had someone review me and said, you know, no wonder it took Nicole 13 years, because she not only talks about NDE, but she puts trauma in a pretty easy way to understand it. It's a very complicated, complex, you know, area. And I try to reduce it down to make it understandable and why it's important that we heal trauma wounds. And a lot of us don't even know that we have them. And what I have seen in my practice is a lot of women, the sex abuse has stayed repressed in them until maybe their 30s or 40s. And then they start having flashbacks. They'll start having things that just are like, this, something's going on with me, you know, and your body keeps the score. That's that book by Bess Van, I forget his last name.
I have heard it. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a trauma expert. It's an excellent book, but your body does remember. And that's why I believe it took my body 19 years for the memory to come out, because I was going to Starbucks, my normal routine. I came back and I got in my car. And as soon as I got in my car, I remembered exactly how I was sitting in the Corvette with my one leg up on the dashboard and the other one across it. And then when the crash happened, I went butt up through the windshield. I cut off my ankle because it was crossed over. And I also cut up the insides of my thighs. I cut a fourth degree laceration between my rectal and erectile anal muscles there. And so it saved my head, you know, in terms of, I mean, I still had a traumatic brain injury because I was unconscious for 12 hours or so, but I didn't have any more head trauma, you know, that I'm aware of. And except I do get a lot of migraines, and then my spine, you know, so I'm not paralyzed or anything like that, but it did cut the nerves in terms of an ability to have sex. And I'm just being honest, you know, and so that's something I never, you know, I didn't get married till I was 40, but I'm never going to be able to experience that like other people do, you know? And it's just, yes, you do change and you become more sensitive. I can't tolerate alcohol. I wish my husband drinks for me. He says, he's a musician, Susan, and yeah. I can't handle loud music. So he has built him a little music cave out in the garage. And, you know, he plays out there, but he's in a band, and it's just like, oh my goodness. You know, I can't handle cigarette smoke or things like that. Just, I absolutely just get sick. And, you know, you really do, crowds can't handle big crowds either. And people's energy, you know, we had the trick or treaters here recently, and, I didn't feel good the next day. And I realized I didn't take a bath or a shower. And I had all these different, you know, hundreds of people coming at me, and I'm giving them candy, and they got really close to they came into my energy field. And, you know, they were wearing some pretty dark costumes, you know? And so it's interesting. As soon as my intuition told me to go take a bath, and as soon as I did, I realized it wasn't my energy it was these people's other energy that got on me that was really making me feel ugh. And that's part of that, me listening to myself, the intuitive part. And it was in the middle of the day, and I didn't care. I was like, I'm gonna go take a bath. And I did, and felt immediately better. So, you know, I have to watch, and we all do have to watch other people's energy climbing onto us.
Absolutely. I find it in shopping centers, and that I struggle with going into shopping centers. I mean, I do it, and you know, but rather than going to the really big ones, I tend to go to the little small shops and go that way. But I don't like big crowds. I don't like that sort of energy either. And one of those things is to bubble yourself, you know, put the protective bubble around you and look after yourself in that way too. But yes, people don't realize how much, how other people's energies affect them so much. And having that near-death experience is, I think, it allows you to get that understanding, because you're coming out of that physical context and going into that spiritual, where you're, even though you talked about like an angel picking you up, or as you said, it was your grandfather picking you up, as you called him Casper the Ghost to start with. But we say it that way because it's easy for us to understand it, because that is logical. It, you know, like in a crazy way, it's logical, because you picture, as soon as you said it, I picture something, you know, a person holding you. Whereas in reality, you're not a person. And they're not a person, you know. In reality, it's just, it's spirit with spirit. But we have to put these images into it for it to make sort of sense in a strange way.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think that's been a really big issue with the concept of God, is we put God in an image. Well, religion has that he's an, you know, we personalize that. Yeah, there's a devil down in the hell, and then there's God with the white beard that's got, you know, he's judging everyone and keeping track. He's dual. He loves you. He protects you on one hand, but yet you experience the wrath of God or punishment or just criticism. So, you know, it's really, you don't really realize how, as a young kid, you really get imprinted with those belief systems that if you're not a good girl or a good boy and you're breaking these rules, that you will die and you will go somewhere bad. You will be separated from God. You'll be separated from your family. And that causes a fear that is terrifying. for anybody to think they're going to be alone.
Mm. And it's that judgment too. It's like, you know, God judges, and no, God doesn't judge.
And that's one of the 10 common lessons that I talk about is there is no judgment. There are no mistakes. You don't even go there, you know? And I can tell you that white light, it wasn't the operating room light. It was what most near-death experiencers see. Raymond Moody, who coined the term near-death experience, said that is the most common characteristic that people that have near-death experience is seeing the white light. And what I realized about that is there on the other side were so many colors. They all don't fit in that 64 Crayola color. No. Right?
They're absolutely.
Yes. There's more colors. And that's why I love the rainbow and I love color, you know, and I was just like,
the music was so, you can't say it was flute. You can't say it was a musical instrument. It was just amazing. Yes.
It's hard to put any of this in words. And I think we all struggle with it because of that. But you think about the color white. We all say it's a clear white light. What does white do? White absorbs all the other colors, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about it, this is the way I like to think about God. There's nowhere God is not. And God is this energy of white light that really is all the other colors combined.
Mm.
And you're just bathed in it. And that's why you feel like an astronaut floating in space. And you feel like this, you know, this, you're in a cocoon and just so safe and so loved and so blissed out, you know, it's like, oh my goodness. You know, I had a little 6-year-old client and I was working with her and her parents were sending her to a very fundamental church. And I asked her how she sees God. And in the book, I talk about this, and she eagerly says to me, "Well, Nicole, God," and she said it straight out, "God is a blue spirit with colors and balloons and all different colors. And it has no head, but it can talk." And I just thought, clearly this little girl is still having a direct experience with God. There's no filters from other people involved. And I hope that she will maintain that because I think she's more on track than anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the kids are, aren't they?
Yes.
We're starting to get a little bit low on time now. Nicole, I do want to mention your book again. So it is You Are Deathless, A Near-Death Experience Taught Me How to Fully Live and Not Fear Death by Nicole Kerr. Where can we get that? From your website or can we get it on Amazon?
You can get it at Amazon. Australia. It's Barnes & Noble. Do you guys have that?
Yes.
Yes, you can order it from that. That's probably the best way to get it. I would love it if you would check it out and review it. You can go on the U.S. site and you can see the reviews on it. And I just, you know, wanted to write this book in order to help people, you know, to really help them understand that death is not something to fear. And if you're in fear, and I actually put a checklist of fears that you may experience about death so that you'll get the conversation started. You know, do you worry about not having a legacy or what's going to happen to your family, you know, things like that. And then there's book club questions. So if you do a book club and have my book as your book of the month, then if the time works out, I'll be happy to pop in on Zoom for about 30 minutes and talk to your book club about whatever questions they may have for me, because it's the book is really, like I said, it's more, the NDE was the spark that that started my spiritual transformative experience. And I don't believe in the duality of God anymore. And that was never true. It was always designed to keep us in fear. And we've got to focus on the positive things that await us. You know, we're never alone. And that's another one that people really get concerned about is, I'm going to be alone. But as soon as you close your eyes, you are met with your angels, your deceased loved ones, you know, they're around you. You are not alone. And I want people to really get that, because during the pandemic, people weren't able to go be with their loved ones and they were really upset. But I think that's more about the person that's still in the human form, you know, and you are deathless. It is your soul lives on. It is, I'm calling myself an eternality advocate now, because your soul has this long trajectory. Okay. And that's what is eternal. And I want people to know that everyone and everything is connected. And this is where we are in the United States with this division that we have, this hate, the racism, all of that, because what I do affects you, Susan. It affects everyone. And this the whole COVID pandemic was a test to see, you know, where are we as a country or as a world about, you know, can I put aside, you know, what I want for the betterment of public health? And, you know, it was shocking to me to have a public health degree and to have people saying what they said and say, oh, we don't need a mask or I don't need this. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, you know, but the number one lesson is we don't die. You know, our souls and spirit live on eternally. And it's a beautiful thing. We go back home and we do a life review at the end to see what we needed to change. But I want to just leave it with, love is the most important thing, and to love yourself unconditionally. And that is the journey we are all on, because most of us grew up with conditions put on the love that we received. And usually it was performance-based.
Yeah. We've got to go. We've run out of time. Thank you, Nicole. Thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Blessings to everybody.
Don't go away. I'll be back in a sec. So, guys, jump on Nicole's website. So it is NicoleKerr.com, NicoleKerr.com. You'll be able to see the book there, all about the book. And you can buy it on Amazon. So you grab it there. And she has put out an offer there for you. So if you do a book club, she's quite happy to jump in and do a 30-minute chat with you, with your book club. So I think that's pretty special, just quietly. I thought that's a lovely idea. I didn't even think of that. Please share, subscribe, like the podcast, and so you don't miss any of the shows. We've got so much coming up for the new year, for everything happening. So I'm really looking forward to that. But that's it for me. Jump onto my website, intuitivenature.com.au, if you want to get any understandings of how to develop your intuition, how to trust your intuition, all that sort of side of it. We've got some online courses there. That's me for now. I will check you next week. So have a great week, and I'll say bye for now. Bye.